Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, we get the latest from Paris as a French presidential candidate gather up a head of steam. Also, as a stolen Cezanne is recovered in the Serbian capital Belgrade, we ask a former Scotland Yard art expert why so much stolen art ends up in the Balkans. And we'll also find out why Brazil keeps it local when it comes to tourism. All that plus some great music and a catch-up with one of our editors. That's on Midori House here on Monocle 24. So lots to pack into the next 60 minutes, but before all that, let's get the latest world headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. UN human rights investigators said today they'd received reports of shelling and arrests by Syrian forces since the ceasefire, as well as executions of some soldiers captured by rebels, although the level of violence generally was lower. The team, led by Brazilian expert Paulo Pinheiro, said it hoped the truce, brokered by international mediator Kofi Annan last week, would hold and help put an end to gross human rights violations that it has documented over the past 6 months. The first UN ceasefire monitors arrived in Damascus late last night. A further 25 are due in the coming days. One opposition leader, Abdulaziz Al-Mussled, said at a news conference in Istanbul that the monitoring mission was not enough and urged the international community to intervene further.
We don't need this slaughter anymore in our country. We need our children to raise in peace and dignity. We don't want this slaughter to exist for another 5 decades in Syria. Please, from here, we ask and we urge for the support and help of the international society.
In Norway, the prosecution presented details of Anders Behring Breivik's attacks on Oslo and Utøya Island last year as the first day of the gunman's court case continued today. 33-year-old Breivik has said he acted in defence of his country by setting off a car bomb that killed 8 people at government headquarters in Oslo last year, then killing another 69 people in a shooting spree at a summer youth camp organised by the ruling Labour Party. The trial is scheduled to last 10 weeks and has raised fears that it could reopen wounds in Norway, a country that prides itself on its tolerant and peaceful society. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai has strongly condemned the attacks yesterday and overnight on areas of Kabul and 3 provincial targets. Heavy street fighting between militants and security forces in the centre of the Afghan capital ended earlier today after 18 hours. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the attacks.
The United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, is monitoring the situation. We need to strengthen the capacity of counter-terrorism efforts and of Afghan national security.
The UN Security Council has strongly condemned North Korea's rocket launch, urged tightening of existing UN sanctions and warned of further action if Pyongyang carries out another missile launch or nuclear test. China, a permanent veto-wielding council member and North Korea's protector on the 15-nation panel, backed the council's presidential statement, which was adopted unanimously. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malik and his Sri Lankan counterpart have held talks on strengthening bilateral relations between the two nations. During the Palestinian visit, the two countries are expected to sign agreements on political consultation, prevention of double taxation and financial evasion. Drumming up support for the Palestinian state is also an important goal of the visit, Malik told journalists at a news conference in Colombo.
The more we sign cooperation agreements on certain areas, the more this really helps. The more we become members of international organizations and UN agencies, that really helps.
And Spain and Italy faced growing market pressure today, stoking fears of a new phase in the Eurozone debt crisis, as Madrid's budget problems threaten to drag in other southern European economies. Yields on Spanish 10-year bonds have climbed over 6.1%, nearing levels that caused general market panic when Italy was in the same position late last year. Spain, the Eurozone's fourth largest economy, is at the centre of the crisis, as concerns grow about some of its banks and the impact of the austerity policies of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy's Conservative government on a struggling economy. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Now let's get the latest weather from Thomas Schaffernacker.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlights, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosau.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
I'm terribly sorry, we don't seem to be able to bring you Thomas just at the moment. What we can do, though, is bring you our top item today, which deals with the French presidential elections. And the venue could not have been more symbolic. Nicolas Sarkozy chose Paris Place de la Concorde, the stage for the revolution's executions, to speak to the crowds to save his presidential neck on Sunday. In a speech so impassioned he looked on the point of explosion, Sarkozy peppered his promises of growth with references to bygone heroes such as Napoleon and de Gaulle. Meanwhile, down the road at the Chateau de Vincennes, François Hollande shouted himself hoarse. He acknowledged his rival's choice of venue, but said this was no time of execution. This was merely a time for change. Well, all this week on Midori House, we'll be chatting about the issues surrounding the presidential elections with Christine Ocrant, the legendary French journalist. We'll be talking to her in just a moment to get her take on today's events. But first, to assess these rallies and to look ahead to the final week, I'm joined from Paris by the Monocle contributor Anna Cunningham. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Anna. Let's start off by saying, what's been the reaction to two such very high-profile and well-attended speeches yesterday?
They were certainly very well-attended in both camps, Emma. And, yeah, definitely a duel of words on the streets of Paris yesterday, as we saw the two forerunners in these elections, Sarkozy and Hollande, really going all out to persuade the voters that they should be the next French president. Now, inevitably, both sides declaring this battle of rallies to have been a huge success, but not quite gleaming reviews in the French press, in particular for President Sarkozy's campaign speech. If we take a look at a few editorials, the French press really has been quite largely scathing, I'd say. There's been many editorialists characterising his address as a deceptive, desperate bid to turn around what looks like an uphill battle for re-election. And you have to remember, this is a big turnaround because Sarkozy was the politician who used to be praised for being dynamic and even transformative. In France's main left-leaning newspaper, Libération, they certainly didn't mince their words. They said Sarkozy displayed a childishness that suggested his current vulnerability. And if we look at the far-left daily L'Humanité, they were even more scathing, referring to Sarkozy's first terms as a period of destruction and describing his speech yesterday as an instance of Dr. Jekyll forgetting his Mr. Hyde. The candidate's words indicating amnesia about a president's acts.
He played his national card very hard, didn't he? And what's been the reaction to his references to so many national figures in his impassioned speech and also a very, very high-profile choice of venue?
Yes, indeed. It was interesting. And much has been made of Sarkozy choosing to speak at La Place de la Concorde. It was a clear marker on the part of his campaign. It's the gateway to the French capital's affluent West. And it was obvious that Sarkozy hoped to evoke memories of mass rallies there in favour of conservative icons Charles de Gaulle, Jacques Chirac, as well as his own victory parade in happier days in May 2007. But, you know, this may be a man on the back foot in terms of this election at the moment. He strided onto the stage, oozing confidence, looking like he had no worries about what the polls might be predicting. And he spoke for 40 minutes solid, and he got more and more animated, telling his supporters, you know, you are France. And as you said, pulling on these historical references, these figures, and really playing that national card. He appealed to the supporters' patriotism. He invoked the names of Napoleon and Charles de Gaulle, and he called for a new social model, a new growth model. But in terms of how that went down, Emma, looking again at the press and these scathing reviews, if you take one publication known as Libé, they summed it up saying Sarkozy presented himself as the heir to both Napoleon and de Gaulle, a double posture that captured the essence of his campaign, nonsensical and inert.
Meanwhile, down the road, François Hollande being given a slightly more, how would you say, playing second fiddle in terms of venue, but nonetheless getting the same number of people to attend his rally. He promised to channel this national anger that he says has been bubbling up over the past few years into government action. What do you think he meant by this?
Well, I mean, you could take this in various ways. You know, there has been a lot of national anger following the shootings in Toulouse a few weeks ago. It brought up the discussion of immigration, of terrorism. He may well have been talking about that, but certainly, you know, he shouted himself hoarse towards the end of his speech. He pressed home the message that as far as he and his party are concerned, change was needed. There's anger amongst people, and that is his campaign slogan, that change is needed now. He was saying, why continue has failed? Why continue going in the wrong direction? And he really said that we must turn the page. France is not bankrupt, is what he said, and it's the leaders who are bankrupt. He interestingly borrowed a term used by John F. Kennedy in his acceptance speech as U.S. president in 1960, and François Hollande, 2012, said more or less the same thing. He said he wanted to set a new frontier for France, but it was a slightly different atmosphere over at the Chateau de Vincennes. They had a music concert before the speech. There was very much more of a diverse gathering amongst the crowd to listen to what Hollande had to say. And I think many here in Paris certainly are saying that this underlines just how confident the socialist camp are now, that they have the best chance in decades of improving their dismal records.
Anna, thank you very much. Sorry to butt in, that's very impolite of me. Anna, thank you very much indeed for joining us down the line from Paris. I'm also delighted to say that we're joined by the legendary French, Belgian journalist, I do apologise, Christine Ocrente, who's on the line from Paris. A very warm welcome back to Midori House, Christine. Anna mentioned there that there was a duel of words held between these two men, but both figures didn't attack each other. Is this a new gentlemanly approach that we can see emerging from the two contenders?
Well, Emma, I wouldn't say so. I think you know how much the French are in love with words. So, as indeed Anna very well described, each candidate addressed his own supporters not to convince them. You know, what's the point? Otherwise, all these people wouldn't have come, hadn't they been already convinced. But it was more, you know, like, how could I put it? Amateur athletes comparing muscles in a village fair. You know, look, I have, you know, 100,000 people. Yes, I have 100,000 people too. I think, again, it's more an exercise, a very traditional exercise, in fact, with no specific message, except that Sarkozy, strangely enough, chose that moment to talk about the European Central Bank, which was quite surreal. Hollande had one message, indeed, because he's quite worried that people will not show up next Sunday, and so his problem is to convince people at large who are fed up with Sarkozy to go and vote on Sunday. So he did not attack Sarkozy personally. That's what he's been doing for the past 6 months, the same way that Sarkozy has been attacking Hollande, but that's what politics tends to be about. But they have the same obsession, in fact. People have to go and vote. Hollande needs a strong show for the first round because he is threatened on his own left by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who conducted a very energetic and old-fashioned campaign. And the same way, Sarkozy is weak in the polls, and so he needs to have what he calls the silent majority show up next Sunday.
Well, let's look at Mélenchon now and see where he would actually fit in, because do you think Mélenchon's supporters will back Hollande, given the fact that he drew a crowd of more than 100,000 people yesterday as well, as well as the two main contenders, albeit on a Marseille beach?
Well, it's not so much a question of figures. It's a question of arguments. Mélenchon keeps attacking Hollande, saying, you know, these kind of socialists have just contempt for the real people
and we are the real proletariat. I mean, his language is extremely old-fashioned. You know, there's the nostalgia of the good old days of Marxist utopia. Nobody should be rich, but then nobody should be poor, and we should take the money where it is, and so on and so forth. He's been very harsh on Hollande. He's been very harsh on the Socialist Party. Nevertheless, it means that his supporters are more likely for the second round, which is on May 6, to rally to Hollande rather than Sarkozy.
Well, let's turn
but
to...
he's threatening Hollande.
Let's turn to Sarkozy now, because he too has to woo everybody to the right of Hollande, doesn't he? But unfortunately, he has to deal with the supporters of Marine Le Pen. Do you think Sarkozy would even want Le Pen's supporters to join him?
Of course, that's what he's been. That's what he's been working at for the past 3 weeks. I mean, his campaign has been extremely sort of hard right. It was the same maneuver which got him elected, by the way, 5 years ago, because then he really managed to weaken Le Pen papa. This time, Marine Le Pen, the daughter, has been clever and very energetic, and although her theories and economic program are just completely... I don't know what word to choose. I mean, just impossible for any rational mind. But nevertheless, she appeals to the working class, people who are really obsessed with unemployment. And you have to realize that for the past 5 years, unemployment in France has not decreased. And so that is Sarkozy's main problem. Especially towards, you know, vis-à-vis Le Pen supporters. But eventually Le Pen supporters will probably, to a degree, rally Sarkozy for the second round.
Christine Lecrant, thank you very much indeed, as ever. And Christine will be joining us here on Midori House every day for the rest of this week to talk about the French presidential election. You're listening to Midori House. It's 17 minutes past the top of the hour. We'll be back in a moment to talk about tourism in Brazil.
This week's culture show has no theme, friends. It's just a tombola of randomly selected winning tickets. We talk TV formats with the editor of Broadcast, investigate hikikomori, that's shutting yourself in your bedroom in Japanese, visit Dallas and Cairo for art, and get on down with live music from the Wave Pictures.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
This week on Monocle 24, we're hijacking the second hour of The Globalist, bubble wrapping it carefully and taking it to the 51st Milan Furniture Fair, Salone del Mobile. We'll be coming to you live each day from 8 to 9 a.m. Central European Time, Tuesday to Friday, from the studios at Il Sole 24 Ore. Join me, Hugo MacDonald, as I bring you the best guests, news, views and reports as events unfold each day. That's at 8 a.m. Central European Time, here on Monocle 24.
And you can join Hugo MacDonald live from Milan from 7 a.m. tomorrow morning on The Globalist on Monocle 24. This is Midori House, so I'm Emma Nelson, and this is Tora Imoy and New Beat. We'll be right back. And that was Toro E. Moy on Monocle 24 and New Beat. It's 23 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House. Welcome back to Midori House. On the beaches of Rio and on the streets of Sao Paulo, it's holiday time. Brazil's tourist trade, like so much of its economy, is booming. But the holidaymakers aren't speaking English or Spanish, but Portuguese. Brazil, you see, likes to keep it local. Last year, 95% of travel and tourism revenue came from the Brazilians themselves. Not even China is as patriotic. Well, in a moment, I'll be speaking to Rodolfo Milesi. He's the founder of Branding Latin America. But first, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to José Francisco López, the director of studies and research from the Brazilian Ministry of Tourism. He began by asking him why Brazil's internal market was so strong.
Mas o mercado interno é forte pelo seguinte, o Brasil é país de quase 200 milhões de habitantes.
Brazil is a country with almost 200 million people. We have a growing middle class that incorporates tourism in its lifestyle, and now we have 50 million Brazilians that travel, which makes almost 190 million trips annually. Brazilians are using all the attractions of the country to travel in, and this will continue for a long time.
What's your plans to attract more foreign tourists? Do you think the Brazilian currency real is overvalued, and maybe that's one of the reasons we don't attract as many people as we could?
In reality, the distances are quite complicated. We had difficulties between 2006 and 2009 because we lost our national airline Varig, which cost us more than 1,600,000 seats, and then there was the 2008 crisis. From 2010, there was a slow recovery. We worked closely with the European market, and they had their own problems recently because of their economic crisis. We're trying to maintain this market, but we need more, and we're working with our offices to work more in South America. South American development is key to improve our tourist infrastructure.
Which type of tourists does Brazil receive?
It's tourists that are very prepared in the cultural point of view and that like the Brazilian attractions. The tourists who come to Brazil usually come back for a second time. We're working on these kind of tourists. It's important to have this loyalty from them. These kind of tourists transmit a good image for Brazil.
How is tourism in Brazil compared to the other BRIC countries?
International tourism is regional mainly. They're mainly attracted to the nearby countries. In quantity, we're closer to India. China, you can't compare. It's been attracting many, many people due to their economic success and size. One interesting thing is that South Africa is more or less like Brazil in terms of tourism, but they have more African tourists than we have South American tourists.
Well, listening to that was the founder of Branding Latin America, Rodolfo Milesi. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Rodolfo. What do you think is the reason for Brazil being so local when it comes to tourism?
Brazilians are very local. They are starting to travel now, especially since the growth of the country and the economy in the last few years. But still, it's a very local population and local inward thinking in reference, for example, or in comparison to the rest of Latin American countries or Latin American culture. I am not surprised that 95% of the tourism in the country is from the country. I am surprised that Brazil is not promoting itself as it should, that Brazil is not maybe developing the tourism infrastructure as it should, especially with the Olympics and the World Cup. And yes, it's quite worrying in a way, but I'm not surprised.
As a branding expert, what do you think Brazil could do to push itself further on the global stage, apart from the fact that it should perhaps lower its prices, because it's now more expensive in Rio than it is in London?
Yes, it is true. What I think they should do is, for example, not to close offices, tourism offices around the world. They closed the Brazilian office, Tourism Authority in London last year and in other cities around the world. I think this is a very bad sign, no, for the image of Brazil abroad. What they should do is, once I interviewed the one communications ministry, and in the brief he told us, look, what we don't want is the 4S. The 4S are samba, sex, sand, and soccer. He said soccer, no, not in American way. So they have this chip in the shoulder about this stereotypical Brazil, and they want to move forward. But so far, at the moment, and that meeting was 3 or 4 years ago, I don't think they have worked enough in terms of rebranding Brazil.
Do you think something like the World Cup and also the Olympics might encourage a change of perception of Brazil?
Yes, but those events are going to happen in the next 2 to 4 years, and Brazil should think more in the next 20 to more years in terms of awareness, in terms of educating people that Brazil is not only the carnival and it's not only the beaches. So there is much more that Brazil should do in terms of the upmarket, in terms of the image to the people that actually is going to São Paulo because it's a business destination and restaurants are great and the hotels are growing. But then after São Paulo, you find a lot of gaps and a lot of things that need to be done to really put Brazil where it should be, you know?
In the interview that we've just heard, José Francisco López talked about targeting the South American market itself. What do you think can be done there?
Yes, it should be more targeted. The problem that they are finding is that if for Londoners is quite expensive at the moment, Brazil, imagine for Argentines, Colombians or Peruvians. So yes, they should maybe target more the South American market, but you know the price is an issue. And if you see today the numbers in 2011, Argentina has received 5.7 international visitors and Brazil 5.2. And this is a very interesting statistic because always Brazil was the leading country in South America, in Latin America after Mexico, because Mexico has worked for longer in terms of awareness and tourism. But Brazil always was the leading country in terms of receiving international tourism, and now is behind Argentina.
Brazil has a rising middle class, so Brazil will probably have a bit more money to spend. What can other countries do to entice these Brazilians to go and spend their real with them? Because we did a piece on the Monocle Daily last week about Brazilians going to Miami because it's so much cheaper, and obviously they've found something that they like there. What can other countries do?
Yes, they can do yes, maybe more in terms of improving and inviting them to come to Brazil. I would say that yes, it's tricky. Now Brazilians are visiting more the country, but also are coming more to London, for example. And a small experience is that, for example, anywhere I go to any hotels in London, all the marketing managers are very interested in the Brazilian market because they know that they spend a lot of money when they come to London, they come to Europe. So yes, there is a potential, but much more to do.
Rodolfo Milesi, founder of Branding Latin America, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Nine minutes up towards the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us because in the next half hour, we'll be celebrating the winners of the Olivier Awards and we'll be asking why art thieves do so love the Balkans. Before all that, let's get the latest news headlines from Nick.
Thanks, Emma. UN human rights investigators said today they'd received reports of shelling and arrests by Syrian forces since the ceasefire, as well as executions of some soldiers captured by rebels, although the level of violence generally was lower. Syrian opposition members arrived in Moscow today for 3 days of talks with Russian officials. In Norway, the prosecution presented details of Arnish Behring Breivik's attacks on Oslo and Utøya Island last year, as the first day of the gunman's court case continued today. A delegation from the Hezb Islamic Party met with Afghan President Hamid Karzai today after heavy street fighting between militants and security forces in the centre of the Afghan capital Kabul ended following 18 hours of gunfire, rocket attacks and explosions. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has spoken to Pakistan's foreign minister about their shared responsibility to confront militants following Sunday's attacks in Afghanistan. The UN Security Council has strongly condemned North Korea's rocket launch, urged tightening of existing UN sanctions, and warned of further action if Pyongyang carries out another missile launch or nuclear test. Frightened residents fled the capital of Guinea-Bissau today and some stockpiled supplies after military chiefs shut the country's air and sea space following their coup 4 days ago. The World Bank has chosen Korean-born American health expert Jim Yong Kim as its new president, maintaining Washington's grip on the job and leaving developing countries questioning the selection process. And Spain and Italy faced growing market pressure today, stoking fears of a new phase in the Eurozone debt crisis, as Madrid's budget problems threaten to drag in other southern European economies. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thanks very much indeed. And Nick will be back at the top of the hour for a full roundup of today's world headlines. Let's get some music, though, now. This is Cruel Intentions by Orgon on Monocle 24. Cruel Intentions there on Monocle 24 by Orgon. The time is 24 minutes to the top of the hour and you're listening to Midori House. Or the big winners at last night's Olivier Awards in London would be more likely to be getting ready for bed on a Sunday night instead of politely thanking their mums on a stage in front of theatre royalty. Four girls aged under 12 jointly took the prize for Best Actress in a Musical. Matilda, the adaptation of the Roald Dahl tale of a little girl with special powers, won a record 7 awards. Well, to talk about all that and all the glitz and glamour from the awards last night, joining me in the studio, I'm very pleased to say, is Matt Wolfe, who's London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune. You were at last night's awards, weren't you, Matt? What was it like?
Well, it was a lot of fun. It's very interesting because the Oliviers are trying to get more and more like the Tony Awards, which are Broadway's big jamboree coming up in June. For a long time, the Oliviers were sort of a best-kept secret. They were in some sort of basement dining room in a glitzy hotel. But unless you were there, you didn't know about it, you might see a paragraph in the paper the next day. Now they're doing the whole red carpet thing. They're getting very buzzy. They had a live hookup to New York. They were on the BBC Red Button. So they are trying to up the game and up their profile.
And is that actually working?
Well, I think it is. I mean, inevitably there's some technical glitches and snafus, but, you know, that always goes with the territory. It's very user-friendly to have a show full of tykes, or as we used to say at Variety, moppets, leading the brigade, because they make great copy. And these four young girls, aged 12, 11, and 10, were, between them, were so adorable.
Tell us about them. I mean, was it charming and delightful to see these little girls?
It was. I mean, you might think, oh, please. But actually, it's really lovely. You'd have to be pretty much of a Grinch to kind of wince at that. And there's a precedent for this, of course. A couple years ago, there were three boys in Billy Elliot who won the Olivier Award for Best Actor as a Musical between them. This time, it's four girls. So I think it's equal time for both genders. What was lovely was that there's a sort of charming song in the show that's a very defining number for the character of Matilda. The song is called Naughty, and it's essentially a solo for the Matilda. What they did last night for the benefit of the audience at the Royal Opera House was have the four girls share the performance of that song, which is very sweet because you get to see them as a quartet, not just as individuals. And then afterwards, at the after party, you might think everyone would have been running around, you know, where's Jude Law? Where's James Corden? Are they even here? And in fact, they were rushing after these four little girls who were being chaperoned by their parents.
Meanwhile, those boys who won the Billy Elliot Awards will be sulking in their teenage bedrooms, respectively, nowadays. Matilda won an unprecedented number of awards. Was that expected from a musical?
Yes. I mean, I think people thought Matilda would do well. It had 10 nominations, and usually the rule of thumb at any awards, it's true, the Oscars, the Grammys, whatever, is whoever's nominated for the most gets the most wins. I think the fact that it won quite as many as it did is a little surprising, not because it doesn't deserve it, it's a lovely show, but because London, unlike New York, opens a lot of shows across the year, about double the number that Broadway does.
It's about 800 to 1,000, isn't it?
Yeah. And so you might think, yes, although not all of those are eligible for Oliviers, but you might think that the Oliviers might spread the wealth a bit more. It just seems to kind of focus it all on one show. Nothing wrong with that show, but it's a little unfair to the others that don't get a look in. One Man, Two Governors, for instance, which is just about to open on Broadway with James Corden, was nominated for 5 awards, got none.
That was a complete surprise because it took the British stage by storm and it took the British press by storm. And now that One Man, Two Governors missed out completely. Are there questions, perhaps, that a play set in 1960s Brighton is going to hit the mark with the New York audience?
Well, you know, a win at the Olivier's on Sunday with a Broadway opening the following Wednesday would have been very helpful for the One Man, Two Governors team in America. On the other hand, and I can say this having just come back from New York where I was for the last 10 days, James Corden, the star of it on Broadway as he was here, is at the moment anyway considered the front runner to win the Tony Award for Best Actor in June. So it could be loss at the Olivier's, win at the Tonys.
Tell us about the other winners of the prize last night. One Man, Two Governors missed out, but Collaborators won.
Yes, well, Collaborators is a national theatre play, as of course was One Man, Two Governors, which is now transferred to the West End to the Haymarket. Collaborators is about Bulgakov and Stalin, set in the era of Soviet terror. A very good production, rather quiet play, quiet production. It hasn't been seen commercially. It was originally written as a screenplay. The screenplay was not produced, and so Nicholas Heitner produced it as a play at the National. Again, a very salutary win, but surprising in light of the success that One Man, Two Governors has had. I was particularly pleased that Anna Christie, which was Eugene O'Neill revival at the Donmar, won Best Actress for Ruth Wilson and also won for Best Revival. The play closed many months ago. Now on Broadway, if a show isn't running, it doesn't win. Luckily, at the Olivier Awards, it doesn't matter whether you're running or not, you can still win.
There was another surprise, though, with the awards, that Collaborators, the main actors, brilliant, Simon Russell Beale, didn't get it, but a surprise couple won, giving it away.
Indeed. Simon Russell Beale and Alex Jennings, the two excellent leads in Collaborators, weren't even nominated, and that in and of itself was a surprise. It was an evening of joint winners. We mentioned the four girls who won for playing Matilda. There were, in fact, two guys who won the Best Actor in a Play prize, and they were Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch, who alternated performances last year at the National as Frankenstein and the Creature. And they've already won several awards, including the Evening Standard Theatre Award, for their kind of unique double act. And I think in that case, it was the fact that history was in the making with those performances in that play. The performances made the play, and it was honouring that.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview the fact that the West End is scooping up all the awards and the Olivier very much targets a certain kind of play. Do you think this is ever going to change, or are we just stuck with this system?
Well, the Olivier Awards are a byproduct of the Society of London Theatre, or what used to be known as Society of West End Theatre, SWET, which was a rather unfortunate acronym, although actors might have liked it because it was very accurate. And in order to be eligible for an Olivier, you have to be working at a certain level. So if you're a terrific production at The Gate or The Bush or whatever, you're just not going to be eligible. That's the way it works. So I think within the self-described parameters, the Olivier's work quite well. I just wish that the panel, because it's all decided by a panel, could be a bit more generous in spreading the wealth around.
Matt Wolfe, thank you very much indeed for coming into Midori House. That was Matt Wolfe, the London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, who was at last night's Olivier's in London. 18 minutes to the top of the hour, you're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be talking stolen art in Serbia, so stay with us.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back. Nobody seemed terribly surprised when Cezanne's boy in the red vest turned up in a car boot in Belgrade last week. Although the recovery itself was remarkable, one need only look at the picture of the robbers face down at a gunpoint in a grass verge to see that its location was however, was no great shock. The Balkans, it appears, is becoming a focal point for art thieves at the moment. And to tell us more is Ria Pryor. Very warm welcome to the studio here at Midori House, Ria. Ria was in the Art and Antiquities squad at Scotland Yard for 3 years. She's now, however, assistant editor for the art newspaper in London. A very warm welcome, Ria. In a moment, I'll ask you about your career change, which is absolutely fascinating. But why the Balkans?
Well, I think to address this, you need to look at why these artworks are turning up for two from two angles, really. Firstly, if you look at the type of artwork that's turning up, these aren't your run-of-the-mill paintings. These are extremely high value. The Cézanne was worth, I think it's estimated around £70 million. Now, for that sort of theft, it's in a museum-type security, you really need criminals that have done their homework. They need to have gone to the museum beforehand. They need to understand the security system in that building. And so for crimes like this, you're really looking at criminal networks. And we know that in Serbia, during the past few, 10, 20 years, there's been a lot of conflict and there have been these rise of criminal networks. And there are a number of gangs.
They've got great names, haven't they? The Balkan Bandits and the Pink Panthers.
Belying
a very serious system, though.
Yeah, extremely organised. They work in all sorts of crimes. I mean, it's not just art crime. It's also drug trafficking. Jewellery gets targeted a lot. But these are serious criminals. And normally art crime will just be a general robber going into a building, picking something shiny. But these are organised. And they're moving the artwork back into Serbia. And these artworks are coming out in surrounding areas, so Montenegro, Macedonia, areas like that, not just in Serbia.
So it's going into Serbia, but the art in itself is not staying in Serbia, I'm assuming. So the Balkans are acting, let me say, as a transit point.
It is essentially a transit point, yes. And we know you also have to look at who's recovering these artworks. And over recent years, local authorities in Serbia have obviously been quite busy with drug trafficking and chasing war criminals. But they are trying to make moves towards, obviously, the government's pushing towards moving to the EU. So law enforcement is getting tougher. And I do think that the local authorities are beginning to look into these crimes a lot more effectively.
If you knew the answer to the question I'm just about to ask you, then you would be probably back at Scotland Yard. But who's actually buying this art to keep it?
Well, there's a lot of theories with all art crime, really. I think people like to think there are these very rich people in these huge houses that are commissioning these crimes. And obviously, with something like a Picasso or Cézanne, you do have to have a bit of money, even if it's on the black market. The Cézanne was going for something, I think it's around £3 million. So these people do have serious money. But generally, art isn't stolen to order. It's generally, they do their research. They know there's going to be people out there who will pay. But a lot of it is a bit of luck. And these artworks, the high-value ones, also move around criminal networks as currency, essentially, as collateral, because it's easier to get across the borders than cash.
Obviously, the issue of due diligence comes to the fore with this, because this is something that has become very important recently. How do they go around the due diligence problem?
Well, I think it is becoming a problem for them. I mean, I know, obviously, the headlines pick up on the fact these artworks are going missing, but if we look at it the other way, these artworks are turning up now. And I think dealers are doing more due diligence. I think there are more recovery companies working out in the region. And to some extent, I think the criminals can't see the profit in it as much as they could. And that's why we're seeing these artworks coming back.
Now, you talk about recovery. How do you go about the process of recovering art such as this? Because I know that the Art Loss Register has launched a campaign targeting Balkan criminals. So they know that the Balkans is the main place to go. How do they go about trying to entice these bits of art back off them?
Well, it's a long process. I mean, whether you're a police, whether you're an insurance company, these investigations are long term. I know the Art Loss Register have been working in the region for a number of years, I think since about 2001, building up contacts, building up the trust of people. For the larger criminal networks, you're obviously going to have to build up contacts. You're obviously going to have to build up intelligence. When you're recovering smaller pieces, it's often when you're just doing a general drug raid or something like that, and these artworks just appear. And there are a number of artworks appearing in the region that no one knows where they were stolen from.
The difficulty is, though, is if you start making contacts, the closer you get into the system, once you are exposed possibly as trying to recover the goods, when they want to get rid of them, these criminals will be getting rid of some very important art if they dispose of it, if they destroy it to try and cover their tracks.
And a lot of artwork that's stolen, I'd say a large proportion, is just destroyed, or a criminal will hide it and forget about it, or will just go missing. So there's this argument always, this balance between recovering the artwork and doing it in a, you know, ethically good, legitimate way, but also you've got to balance that risk out of losing the artwork forever. So they're extremely lucky the Cézanne wasn't damaged.
Now, you worked at Scotland Yard, but then jumped into the art world. How does someone like Scotland Yard work internationally to try and, what international laws are now coming in place to make sure that the Balkans can be targeted as any other region can be?
I mean, I think the laws are already in place. Obviously, every region has different laws, so I think the problem is harmonising those laws and getting countries to pass intelligence together. And I do think there have been moves recently. Interpol has obviously become more prominent. People are using it a lot more. And I think the communication between countries, the CESAN, I believe it's the Swiss police and local authorities working together. So it's a slow process, but I do think the laws are there. It's just working.
There's also a discussion of an EU-wide law, isn't there, to strengthen international cooperation?
I think that's been a discussion for quite a while. I don't know how quickly these things are going to come about.
Very briefly, how did you swap jobs? I know we've run out of time and I'm terribly sorry. How did you swap jobs from Scotland Yard to art?
Well, I actually started as an art historian. It went a bit wrong and I ended up in Scotland Yard. And then I retrained as a journalist. So now I'm back at the art newspaper now.
I'm very glad we are too, because it meant that you can come into Midori House to talk to us about that, about the Balkans. Thank you very much indeed. That was Ria Pryor, former art and antiquities squad member at Scotland Yard, now an assistant editor of the art newspaper in London. The time is 10 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
May's Monocle is a well-behaved, waggy-tailed issue that looks at how Japan's passion for poodles and miniature pooches has generated a St. Bernard-sized business sector. We also get a preview of how our cities will look in the future at the world's most important real estate fair, talk soft power with the Goethe Institute, and find a hood to call home in Buenos Aires. And there's much more. In the business section this month, we get up close and personal with man's best friend in Japan, looking at Tokyo's booming luxury pooch preening market and what it says about the country's social and economic outlook. We also report on the recent resurgence in Turkish heritage brands, meet the cousins who still run the fine leather brand Hermes, and have an in-depth report on the horological highlights of Baselworld Watch Fair.
In the edit section, we open our sheds and explore a Dutch toolmaker that's been leading the gardening business for years. We also share a roast chicken recipe from a cozy takeaway in New York and tip our readers on a trendy Pilates studio in Seoul.
There's also our 36-page travel guide to Thailand, our annual design directory, and Monocle's Helsinki City Survey. The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. It's Monday, which means it's time to check in with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to hear which stories we should be watching this week. And I'm very pleased to say, Steve, you've joined me live
I'm
in
here.
The studio. Thank you for coming in.
It's quite all right. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Oh, you're such a sweetie. So what should we be watching this week before these platitudes continue?
Yes, indeed. So there are a few things to look at. Let's start with the breaking news. Jim Yong Kim has just been named as the new head of the World Bank. Little surprise, because is it because he's best qualified? Is it because he has the most experience? No, it's because he's American.
Right. As simple as that.
As simple as that. The head of the World Bank has always been an American, just like the head of the IMF has always been European. And we saw last year when Dominic Strauss-Kahn had to, for personal reasons, let's say, had to step down as head of the IMF, that there was a bit of a kerfuffle amongst some of the developing countries and, let's face it, some of whom have far larger economies than many of these so-called developed countries now, over whether this thing should carry on as it had in the past. In the end, it did, and Christine Lagarde got the IMF job. Mm. And now, with Bob Zolik stepping down as the head of the World Bank, we've had a similar sort of thing where, you know, lots of other countries said, well, look, hang on, just because it's always been American in the past, should it be this time? And despite the fact that there was a very, very good candidate, the current, in fact, Nigerian finance minister, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who has worked at the World Bank before and has done a fantastic job as finance minister of Nigeria two times, probably would have been the best candidate for the job as well. But
possibly, but Russia and Mexico wanted Kim. Tell us a little about Kim, because he's not your traditional banker, is he? He's got a PhD in anthropology and he's a graduate of Harvard Medical School.
Indeed, he's a doctor and he's got a lot of experience on HIV/AIDS. He's the former director of the HIV/AIDS department at the World Health Organization. So he's a leading figure, really, in global health, which makes him sort of very different from a lot of the previous people that have done this job before Robert Zoellick, who was a US administration guy. You'd had Paul Wolfowitz, who, of course, was, you know, the rather hawkish member of the George W. Bush security team. So yes, Mr. Kim is a little bit different, it's fair to say, and may actually be very good. Who knows just yet. But the way the whole thing has happened, this was never a contest. It was always going to be him.
And there has been quite critical reaction of it straight away. I mean, the news has just broken, but we're watching the responses coming through. South African Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan criticises the selection, saying it falls short for not being transparent or merit-based.
Yep.
A former official at the International Monetary Fund now saying that the bank's approval of Kim reflects how global governments continue to lag behind changing economic realities. This is not a good start, is it?
No, it's not. It's not a good start for him. And I think over the coming days, we're going to see a lot of debate about the West's belief in democracy, which, you know, we're all very happy to preach. But when it comes to the crunch in certain situations, perhaps not so happy to see working in practice. And I would not be surprised if there is a little bit of discussion about whether, well, look, maybe next time around, let's make it a bit more transparent. Let's make it more of a fair fight.
Now let's move on to the Summit of the Americas, which dominated the headlines this weekend until it failed, until there was no declaration.
No, indeed. And so this is another way that the US in particular has perhaps got on the wrong side of some of the more emerging economies in the world. So the Summit of the Americas is a meeting of the heads of state of all 35 countries in the Americas, North, South and Central. It was happening in Cartagena, Colombia. We've actually covered quite extensively on the Monocle Daily, where Anastasia Maloney, who's a Bogota correspondent, she's been up in Cartagena for us over the last few days. She's going to be on tonight as well at 2200 hours on the Daily, giving us her take on what happened over the weekend. But I think what's quite interesting is you've seen again this sort of split between the US and everyone else on two major issues. One is Cuba and the issue of the US blockade of Cuba and the US's view that Cuba shouldn't be involved in some of the Americas.
This has been something that's been going on for ages and ages and ages. And even Argentina waded in last week and said, this will be the last summit without Cuba. Do you think that the summit can only continue with Cuba in the absence of the United States? Because that seems to be where the real sticking point is.
It's possible that once the 2012 presidential election in the US is out of the way, that it might be easier for Obama to say, you know, next time around, look, yeah, okay, fine. Invite Cuba. I mean, really, what's the worst thing that's going to happen if, you know, Obama and Raul Castro are in the same room? I mean, really. They talk to worse people. But I think what's interesting on this is you've got, as I say, there's the issue of Cuba. There's also the issue of drug legalization,
which was an absolute mess because no one could really decide what to do apart from blame the outside world for excessive consumption.
Yes, and Juan Manuel Santos, the president of Colombia, was very clear. He wanted it on the agenda. He wanted it being discussed, but it didn't happen.
No, it wasn't. It didn't happen. I think Ecuador wanted to legalise the whole business as well.
Yeah, you can't see Obama signing up for that.
Not really what you're going to say. Yeah. No, it's not going
to
happen.
Just time to say one last thing?
Yes, very quick. We've got 10 seconds.
Okay. Syria, the peace monitors, there's only 30 of them. They won't be able to do their job, but it doesn't matter because it's just the start of a process. China and Russia are now locked in. It'll be very interesting to see what happens with that.
Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor. A pleasure as ever for joining us. That's all we've got time for on this Monday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Alex Jakes. At 2200 hours London time, that's in 3 hours' time, you can join Tom Burgess-Watson and Christian Yoke for The Daily. But from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye.